From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. On today's programme, after Uganda adopts a controversial anti-gay law, we examine the role US evangelists have played in driving the bill through.
But what are we going to do to save the lives of LGBT human beings in Uganda? Because they'll die, and we have to be honest about that.
Here in the US, Arizona is also in the grip of anti-gay legislation. We hear from a protesting pizza restaurant owner there. Our correspondent on the Hill brings us reaction to the sweeping US military cuts. And we're in London to find out why bomb shelters are now home to farm animals.
We were debating the future of London, population growth, what we're going to do with food, we're running out of land. He was an enthusiastic student and I was a cynical old man.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has warned his Afghan counterpart that the U.S. is planning to withdraw all its troops from the country by the end of 2014. Mr. Obama spoke to Hamid Karzai by telephone this Tuesday, saying that since the Afghan leader has refused to sign a bilateral security agreement with Washington, the Pentagon has no option but to plan for a full withdrawal. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
This is the latest twist in a long-running saga of deteriorating relations between President Karzai and the US. Having initially seemed in favour of the BSA, or bilateral security agreement, which would have left several thousand US troops in Afghanistan after the end of 2014, Hamid Karzai then decided to leave any decision on that to his successor after April's election. That's made it very difficult for the Pentagon and its NATO allies to begin the complicated process of planning troop movements. Nonetheless, Mr. Obama has left open the possibility of making a deal on a post-2014 mission with the next Afghan government.
Ukraine's interim president says the country must be vigilant to the dangers of separatism following the ousting of President Viktor Yanukovych. There is anger in some Russian-speaking regions of Ukraine about his removal. Meanwhile, Ukraine's interim government has put Yanukovych on its most wanted list, accusing him of mass murder. And U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says that the U.S. is deeply engaged in trying to help the people of Ukraine. Speaking alongside British Foreign Secretary William Hague, he said that both countries are committed to supporting them. Kerry said it's vital that the Ukrainians make their own decisions about their future.
This is not a zero-sum game. It is not a West versus East. It should not be. It is not Russia or the United States or other choices. This is about Ukrainians making their choice about their future. And we want to work with Russia, with other countries, with everybody available to make sure this is peaceful.
The U.S. has expelled three Venezuelan diplomats in response to Venezuela's removal of three U.S. embassy staff last week. Venezuela accused the U.S. representatives of supporting an anti-government protest movement that is sweeping the country. The move came shortly after Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro announced that he would nominate an ambassador to the U.S. for the first time since 2010. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
Despite previously accusing Washington of supporting the violent protests, President Maduro said that his nomination will be an attempt to kickstart relations between the two countries. In response, the White House urged President Maduro to prioritize fixing relations domestically before turning his focus on international affairs. Over the past 2 weeks, 13 people have been killed and 150 injured in the student-led protest movement against the Maduro government, which they blame for shortages, high crime, and inflation. Last week, President Maduro expelled three U.S. diplomats who he accused of recruiting students to the protest movement.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The war in Syria has ignited a fresh debate on the use of cyber warfare and security in the U.S. It follows recent discussions at the meeting of the National Security Council. Rebecca Hume reports from Washington.
The National Security Council, which met last Thursday, declined to discuss details of its interagency deliberations. Caitlin Hayden, spokesperson for the National Security Council, confirmed the administration does have a range of materials, including cyber weapons, to protect the U.S. from outside threats. The New York Times is reporting that the US has been engaged in secret talks over whether offensive cyber weapons should be used as an alternative to traditional military warfare in cases such as Syria. Discussions centre around whether cyber arms should be used covertly or as regular weapons. One of the main issues is whether a cyber strike on Syria would be seen as a justified humanitarian intervention.
Prominent Tokyo-based Bitcoin exchange Mt. Gox has ceased all transactions and taken its website offline. The move comes a month after the company reportedly lost hundreds of thousands of Bitcoins in a cyber attack. The cyber theft reportedly cost users nearly $370 million. And Reuters has reported that Iran has inked a nearly $200 million deal with neighboring Iraq. The Obama administration says they're seriously concerned and asserts that Iran selling arms to any country violates a UN resolution. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer is coming under increasing congressional and commercial pressure to veto an anti-gay bill. Under the law, businesses could refuse to serve homosexual customers based on religious grounds. As companies, including Apple and American Airlines, opposed the move, politicians warned of the negative impact the law could have on the state's economy. For more on the details of the bill and Governor Brewer's next move, I spoke to political correspondent with TheHill.com, Mike Lillis.
Sure. Well, there was a bill that passed through the state legislature last week. It landed on Governor Jan Brewer's desk on Monday, yesterday. And what it says is that if you're a business operating in the state, you can refuse service to people for any reason based on religious belief, in effect. And the target here is the lesbian and gay community. And so the pushback has been pretty fierce, and we'll see if she vetoes it or not. But there's not much else to add to it. I don't think it's a conservative legislature. It's a conservative governor. It's a conservative state, and these are the types of laws that these Tea Party groups have been pushing. Although Arizona is the first state to actually enact one of these proposals, not the first state to see one of these proposals introduced. But it was the first to enact one, and that's why I think you're seeing so many headlines. The history of this country, we've gone through this a lot. You know, women weren't allowed to vote. Blacks weren't allowed to sit, in the same school bus or drink out of the same soda fountain as other people. And so the LGBT community is saying, hey, wait a minute, if these things apply to these other groups, what about us? Aren't we people too? And so they're just saying it's pure discrimination, no other way to spin it. And religious beliefs are not. If you know your religious belief, you can't claim a religious belief to kick an African American out of your store, or a woman out of your store. So why would you be able to kick a lesbian out of your store? That's their argument.
Pressure on Governor Jan Brewer to veto the bill hasn't just come from Congress, but there's also been a commercial pressure applied now.
An enormous business element, and you're seeing a lot of that this week. Even Senators John McCain, Senator Jeff Flake, those are the two Republican senators from Arizona, have both come out asking her to veto it. Apple came out and asked her to veto it. The CEO for American Airlines is opposed to it. There's a group that's calling for a boycott of the entire state. The Super Bowl, the professional football main event, is scheduled for Glendale, Arizona, in 2015. There's already a petition to have it moved. The governor of Delaware has asked for the Super Bowl to be moved elsewhere for this very reason. So the pressure is really mounting on her not to sign this bill, to veto it. And in fact, three of the Republican state senators who supported it last week have already changed their minds, and they wrote a letter to Jan Brewer yesterday and said, hey, we're hearing a lot of pushback from the business community. We don't want this to harm Arizona's reputation. We want the state to be seen as a friendly place, as a place where people can come and do business from all walks of life. And so they are also asking her to veto it just a couple days after they supported it. So all indications are that she will veto it. That she hasn't done so, I think, is just indication that she's not in the state right now. She was in Washington for a couple days for the National Governors Association annual meeting, and she'll be back later this afternoon in Arizona, and I don't think that it will take very long before she vetoes it.
Mike Lillis from TheHill.com. One businessman that's made public his objection to the law is Rocco De Grazia of Rocco's Little Chicago Pizzeria in Tucson, Arizona. I spoke to Mr. De Grazia and asked him what inspired him to put the sign, "We reserve the right to refuse service to Arizona legislators," in his restaurant window.
Well, we've always been putting up snarky signs on our marquee or indoors, and one of my customers supplied me with a sign that very succinctly summed up the views that I have on SB 1062, and I couldn't hit print fast enough on that sucker, so that's why it's up.
What exactly about this bill has inspired you to push back like this?
Well, it's just restricting the rights of some citizens with ill regard to those of others. I think we already have freedom to refuse service to all, even though some other states have had litigations to the contrary. And also, you know, there is plenty of religious freedom in this country and this state and all the other states, as far as I'm concerned. So I don't think we need more laws to safeguard already safeguarded religious freedom.
And you, and for those people who haven't seen the sign, can you explain what it actually reads?
Yeah, it says, "We reserve the right to refuse service to Arizona legislators."
And does that include Governor Jan Brewer, who of course will eventually have to take that vote whether or not to veto the bill or let it pass?
Yeah, well, let's see what she does. I've actually had a few legislators come in here show me their voting record and ask for a pizza. So, you know, it is actually coming into play in a certain extent.
And Rocco, have you had any feedback from any gay or lesbian lovers of your pizza, your deep crust?
Yeah, it's been overwhelmingly positive. And I didn't do it for any particular reason other than humanitarian reasons and personal views. So I'll take the kudos where they're given, but, you know, I'm not trying to drum up business. I'm just... We're just snarky that way.
And finally, Rocco, that you're just one of many businesses, it seems, who are starting to sort of stand up, put their message to Governor Brewer to say, don't do this. It's going to hit us where it hurts in the wallet.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're just the ones that the camera got trained on. That's it. I've got restaurant association members, other businesses who are fully of the same mind as myself or possibly not as vocal, but... we all know what's going to happen if this bill gets passed.
And what's good to eat there, Rocco?
What's good? Everything. We have a full gamut of Chicago pizza and pasta specialties for you perusal.
Rocco De Grazia in Arizona. This is FSN Reports. In what's been branded a witch hunt against Uganda's gay community, a national tabloid has published the identities of what it calls the country's top 200 homosexuals. The list was released just one day after President Yoweri Museveni signed a law which could see gay people imprisoned for life. US Secretary of State John Kerry said the law marked a tragic day for Uganda. The role of the US in driving the controversial bill has also entered the debate, with reports of US evangelists pushing a conservative anti-gay message in Uganda. For more on this, I spoke to Kapaya Kaoma, senior religion and sexuality researcher for the social justice think tank Political Research Associates in Massachusetts.
The whole thing started with the American conservative extremists who went to Uganda in 2009. I happened to be in Uganda that time studying the relationship between African Christianity and American conservative Christianity. That's the time when they came to Uganda and hosted what they called the seminar on exposing the international gay agenda. And one of the speakers is Scott Library here in Massachusetts and in Springfield. He told the Ugandans about the threat which was coming from the international gay agenda, which in fact linked to what happened in Nazi Germany, that the gays were the ones who are responsible for what happened there. And he told them that the only way you are going to protect yourself is to have bills or laws that will make it impossible for the gay movement to penetrate Uganda. But he also warned them that there's no country which has stopped the international gay movement from taking over the country, and he was hoping that Uganda would be the first country to do that.
Could you expand a little bit more on what form this conservative American evangelist mission took in Uganda?
The moment they started pushing for this bill, they got a lot of support from American evangelicals. People were thinking that by trying to dismiss Bahati as an extremist, the American conservatives would distance themselves. Bahati himself has said on TV that, in fact, what has happened is the opposite. The moment they started pushing for this bill, a lot of American conservatives have been supporting them. In fact, by his own words, he says that the support, meaning the financial support, tripled when they introduced that bill in Parliament.
What's happening in Uganda? This is part of a wider trend on the continent. I saw a human rights report recently talk about the fact that there were some 38 states there now embracing anti-homosexual legislation.
Yes, that is true. And this is some of the things we are worried about as political research associates. Because when this bill was going on, we tried to stop it. People tried to stop it. The U.S. government was involved. The other government, international governments were involved in trying to ensure that the bill is defeated. What had happened again within that time is when this whole thing blew up in Russia, with the law passing in Russia. At that time, people thought the law in Uganda was extreme. But when Russia passed the bill, Nigeria followed suit and passed the bill. Then Uganda has passed the bill. And other African nations, as we are speaking, who got that way. Already in Kenya, there is this demand by the MPs that they get a similar kind of bill. Now, you might be saying, oh, this is just happening coincidentally. Not at all, because Scott Libre himself has been part and parcel of those who led to what happened in Russia. He's been working on that, writing letters to the parents of Russia, again lying that gay people in every community to destroy people's children. There are some other American conservatives who have done the damage as well. For instance, we can talk about Sharon Slater of the Family Watch International. She's a Mormon, and she runs this organization which, in fact, does the same kind of work which Scott Lively does, that is going around Africa, telling African nations that there is a movement to destroy the family, and that movement is linked to the American gay movement. And your duty is to try by all means to stop that.
I'm just wondering what you think should be done by the United States government politically in response to this anti-homosexual legislation.
We can have selective sanctioning each politician who voted for this bill. They should not go to Europe. They should not come to America. We should sanction Museveni and his family. And if they have ministers, if they do have relatives in Europe, those countries must deport their relatives back to Uganda, because they should feel the pinch. If we cut aid, it's the poor person in Uganda who feel the pinch. If we have targeted sanctions to the scientists who came up with that report and said we should have the law, if we sanction those groups, then they will feel the pinch. And I tell you, they will start negotiating with us. But cutting aid in Uganda to the Ugandan public is not the way to go, because they will still continue sending their kids in international colleges, international universities. They will continue going to Europe to do their shopping using the little money they have. What I'm pleading for are targeted sanctions to every pastor who has stood for this bill. He or she must be targeted and sanctioned by the U.S. government, sanctioned by the European Union, and be isolated. The same with parliamentarians, the same with the cabinet, the same with the Museveni family. And I tell you, there will be a possibility of repealing this bill, and African countries, other African countries, will learn from this experience.
Kapaya Kayoma. President Obama has ordered the Pentagon to make plans for a full withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan by the end of the year. This as the US military rolled out a budget this week that cuts down the size of the armed forces and scraps some weapons and programs entirely. But even as they cut housing and healthcare subsidies for military families and shut down bases at home and overseas, the military is doing little to address the billions lost every year through waste and fraud. From Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein brings us the reaction to the announcement.
Chuck Hagel outlined his vision for the future of the country's armed forces in a speech at the Pentagon this week, where he cited the current national budget crunch and the approaching conclusion of the country's longest war.
We are repositioning to focus on the strategic challenges and opportunities that will define our future. New technologies, new centers of power, and a world that is growing more volatile, more unpredictable, and in some instances, more threatening to the United States.
Hagel proposed cutting the number of active duty soldiers by about 100,000, but plans to add more than 3,000 Special Operations Forces members, and plans to increase the number of armed drones so that between 55 and 70 are flying around the world at all times. And following the attacks in 2012 on U.S. diplomats in Benghazi, they also plan to deploy 900 more Marines for embassy security around the world. Additionally, they plan to substantially invest in the so-called pivot to Asia and in the military's cyber warfare capabilities. The Pentagon also plans to save money by slowing the growth of military pay and cutting back the subsidies military families receive for health care and housing. Secretary Hagel described this decision as a balancing act.
We recognize that no one serving our nation in uniform today is overpaid for what they do for our country. But if we continue on the current course without making these modest adjustments now, the choices will only grow more difficult and more painful down the road.
The budget won't be submitted to Congress until next week, but many lawmakers on Capitol Hill are already blasting the proposal, including Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn.
I didn't see the savings where the savings need to come from. What they're doing is cutting troops, the people that defend us, and cutting real expenditures on real materiel and training, and leaving in place the inefficiencies and incompetencies that's there.
Coburn outlined some of these inefficiencies in a report a few months ago called The Waste Book, which detailed billions he would cut from different military programs, such as $10 million currently going to National Guard ads tied in with the latest Superman movie, and $300 million for a surveillance blimp that was never used. Ethan Rosencrans, a national security analyst with the Project on Government Oversight, says much more money has been wasted in Afghanistan, where budgets are subjected to even less government scrutiny.
We're building facilities in Afghanistan that the Afghans have no intention of ever using.
As talks continue between President Obama and President Karzai over a U.S. military presence in Afghanistan after 2014, the entire overseas contingency part of next year's budget is still a giant question mark. A statement from the White House Tuesday said Karzai has demonstrated that it is unlikely he will sign an agreement to keep tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers in his country. President Obama said he's ordered the Pentagon to plan for an orderly withdrawal of all troops by the end of the year. But Rosencrans and other government watchdogs say they remain concerned that the military will continue to treat war spending as a slush fund.
Unfortunately, over the past few years, the Pentagon has what we call migrated funds from its base budget into the war funding account. That includes funding for the Afghan security forces. That also includes funding for Afghan reconstruction and development projects. Both of those accounts are rife with waste, fraud, and abuse. We fear that the Pentagon will continue this practice, perhaps for the next 2 or 3 years, even if troops are completely redeployed from Afghanistan.
As lawmakers, veterans groups, and pundits blast the cuts the Pentagon has proposed, saying they'll put U.S. national security in jeopardy, Rosencrans reiterated that the U.S. will continue to spend more on its military than the next 10 countries combined. Congressional committees are expected to begin debating the 2015 budget next week. In Washington, I'm Alice Ulstein.
two entrepreneurs with no background in farming have established what they believe to be the world's first underground farm in a disused tunnel, 100 feet under a busy London neighbourhood. The tunnels were built as air raid shelters during World War II, but have laid empty since that time. Now, the two school friends have spent 18 months developing the idea of an underground farm and have begun to grow crops, with an expansion to full commercial scale due later this year. Our reporter Catherine Drew went deep underground for a day on the farm.
Clapham is a busy neighbourhood in South London, and as traffic roars by the high street, you'd be forgiven for not noticing an old building fenced off by the side of the road. It looks abandoned. And that's what it has been since the end of the Second World War, when the series of tunnels that was shelter from enemy bombs for up to 8,000 people was sealed off and abandoned. That is, until around 18 months ago, when a couple of entrepreneurs approached the owners, the London Transport Authority, with an unusual idea to create an underground farm. Down a staircase over 30 metres underground, it's a lot more peaceful, with only the occasional passing train overhead to disturb the quiet. It's also surprisingly cosy. In one corner of the vast tunnel network, an area has been tented off and fully lit. Here, a new food company called Zero Carbon Foods is growing herbs and vegetables. Stephen Dring is one of the co-founders.
It kind of sprung out of a pub conversation. We were debating the future of London, population growth, what we're going to do with food, we're running out of land. He was an enthusiastic student and I was a cynical old man. And we would argue about it, and it kind of came from that and a film that Rich was doing as a film student about underground London.
Stephen and his friend Richard Ballard have just signed a 25-year lease to use these tunnels. Growing is already underway, with trays of rocket, pak choi, cress and other produce lined up under artificial light. The crops, with a brand name Growing Underground, will be produced using minimum carbon, as Richard Ballard explains.
The LEDs that we use are 100 watts, and they give off a small amount of heat on the back, but they don't on the front, so the plant, it doesn't affect the growth of the plant. That extra heat warms the environment, and when we're growing this on a three-tier system, this tunnel is a 16 degrees year-round from through the winter through to the summer. So with that extra heat, we can take it up to a nice 18 to 22 degrees, which is perfect for the crops that we're growing. So we don't have to put any excess heat in.
Another perk to growing crops underground is that pesticides will not be needed, as no pests will be able to get through the tunnel's ventilation system, already in place from its World War II days. And with the crops being grown in London, there will be minimal so-called food miles, the carbon expended to deliver food. Stephen Drink says any remaining carbon used in the business will be calculated and offset by various means.
Without doubt, we're going to be carbon neutral. It's in the name, it's something we believe in, and we believe that we can grow this way and not have an impact on the environment. It's all about that belief that in the future we will live in a carbon-free economy.
So far, the pair have raised a fraction of the $1.6 million needed to turn this enterprise into a commercial farm, with 10,000 square metres of herbs and vegetables and around 15 to 20 staff. However, they say there is a huge amount of interest in the project and are confident the farm will be in full production by September, with the first crops sent to London markets shortly after that. And with so many miles of tunnels available, the farm does have the capacity to expand for years to come.
Our reporter, Catherine Drew, in London. And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Wednesday, following President Obama's order to the Pentagon, we look at the troubled relationship between the US and Afghanistan. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.